Maurice Stretton Reel 3. Now, at the end of the 2 years, there was an exam for you to sit.
Yes, quite a tough one too. And besides consisting of the local marks, which was the result of the examinations that we'd taken during the 2 years we were there, we had an examination in typing, shorthand, a written examination in the main clerical work that we'd learned, REF regulations, with having to remember actual quotations from KR and ACI, and also a VV when we were questioned for about 20 minutes each by, I can't remember whether it was two or three officers.
And how did you get on in the exam?
In the exam, I got just a fraction over 80%. Lucky for me, because 80% one passed out LAC, 60% AC1, and 40% AC2. And, of course, it meant quite a difference in one's pay, how one passed out. And the fact that I got just a fraction over 80 was lucky for me, because there were quite a few who got a fraction over 79, but they still passed out AC1. There was, I'm afraid, no sympathy at all there. If it was under 80, even by 0.01%, one was passed out AC1.
Can you remember how much difference it made to the pay?
Oh, yes, indeed. An LAC passed out and was paid 4 and 6 a day. An AC1 was paid 3 and 9 a day. An AC2 was paid 3 shillings a day. Now, that doesn't say, sound very much, perhaps, but one has to take into account, of course, that one was clothed and housed, and it was virtually pocket money. And when one thinks that in those days a skilled artisan only got about £3 a week, and then one compares an LAC clerk at 31 and 6 a week, having that virtually as pocket money, one can say, well, he was well paid. I do know this, that I managed to run a little Austin 7 on it about 12 months later.
Can you remember when you went home on leave from Ryslip as an apprentice? Can you remember when you got back home what your contemporaries from school, how they were getting on? How did you feel your lot compared with theirs?
Almost without exception, they were waiting for better things. They were waiting for things to turn up. I did not regret at all the fact that I had gone into the Air Force as an apprentice. I sort of had a lift taken off my shoulders, a lift higher from my mind, a great weight off my mind.
In 1933, when you finished the apprenticeship, you were then sent to Upper Heyford to 57 Squadron. What were your actual duties there?
There I was the orderly room clerk. Only two of us, a corporal and an airman. The airman could be an LAC, AC1 or AC2. And there we looked after all the records of the squadron. But it was far wider than the records of the record office at Ryslip, which only looked after just the records of airmen. Whereas at as an orderly room clerk, one looked after the clerical side of everything appertaining to the squadron. Flying, stores, policy, officers' records, airmen's records, everything. Very interesting, I found it. Very interesting indeed.
And how did life compare there with life at Risley?
I was in heaven, completely. Life was so easy. The food was so good. The discipline was so lax. Immediately, I was allowed to wear civilian clothes. And in those days, that meant an awful lot. One wasn't proud of being in uniform, as some people might think. Later on, after the war broke out, yes. But in those days, during the Depression, one wasn't proud of being in uniform. And one was very pleased to be able to wear civilian clothes. But because I had reached the age of 19, I was 19 in a few days when I got to 57 Squadron, I was allowed to wear civilian clothes. The regulation was that an ex-apprentice had to be 12 months out of apprenticeship and also be at least 1 year after the age of 18.
Did you have any regrets now that you were with a squadron that you'd chosen to be a clerk, so that you're now in the office rather than the workshop?
Yes, I did. For two reasons. First, I was passionately fond of flying and mixing with the fitters and the riggers, living with them, talking with them. I knew then that that's where my interests lay. And also, too, of course, aircraft apprentices, they took trades which carried more pay than clerks. For instance, an LAC fitter or an LAC rigger, he got 5 and 6 a day, as against my 4 and 6. Possibly, I must have missed that when I went through the papers that were given to me as a lad, but it hadn't been pointed out to me. Otherwise, I might have thought a little differently from what I had. But I did. When I was on the squadron, I regretted very, very much. And also, too, the chances of becoming a pilot from one of the tradesmen who worked on aircraft were much better than for clerks. Also, too, of course, the airmen who worked on aircraft were able to be air gunners. This was before the air gunners courses that were reintroduced at the time war broke out, or just prior to the war. In these days, all air gunners were ground tradesmen, no commissioned air gunners at all. They were ground tradesmen, and they were paid 1 and 6 pence a day extra. Well, of course, I was excluded from that because I was a clerk, even volunteering to be an air gunner. Only the fitters, riggers, armourers, wireless operators could become air gunners. So I, at this particular time, I thought, well, I'm really suffering for being a clerk.
How did you actually get on with the men from the workshops? Did they get on well with
you? Oh, yes, very well. I used to go about with them the whole time. In fact, I had nothing to do with clerks at all, the whole of the time that I was at Upper Hayford. Not that there were many. There were two more squadrons there, and so there were four more clerks in their offices, and then, of course, there was the headquarters at Upper Hayford. I suppose they would have had about four or five clerks. So I doubt whether there were more than about 10 on the station.
Was there any chance now for you to do some flying at Upper
Hayford?
Oh,
yes, I did quite a lot, purely as a passenger. As I said, I couldn't be an air gunner. But a lot of trips didn't need an air gunner, and the pilot very often would fly solo when he was testing an aircraft after its inspection or something like that. He'd fly solo unless I bothered, if I wasn't busy in the office, and a quick word with my corporal in the office, and he was a decent sort. Jack, I'm going into the hangar for half an hour. Okay, isn't it? Yes. You've got nothing to do particularly, have you? Nothing I can't catch up on? Okay. I'd go into the office and see one of the pilots there, whether it be a commissioned officer or an NCO pilot, didn't make any difference. And look at the authorization, flying authorization book. See who was down, if I could see somebody flying solo, so-and-so, testing aircraft number so-and-so. And if it was there was nobody flying with him, I'd go along and say, do you mind if I come up with you for a bit of flying experience as your passenger? Not at all. Grab yourself a parachute. You're welcome. Oh, it was very easy on the squadron.
Did you get any instruction then or at any time up to the war in learning to use a parachute?
Oh, not at all. No. Not even after, later on when I was an actual pilot. One never had any instruction in using a parachute. The only thing one had was, when I was a pilot, watching it being packed. And that was part of one's training, to see a parachute packed. I don't know how it helped one, but that was part of the training, to see a parachute packed. Otherwise, it was, now put this parachute on, see this ring here? Well, give it a good pull if you're in trouble, and jump out and pull it, or jump out, count three and pull it. That was the nearest I ever got to using a parachute, until I used one to save my life.
The officers that I've spoken to very much wanted their squadron to be the best at everything and to win all the competitions and so on. Did you feel involved in your squadron's performance in competition with the other squadrons on the base, for instance?
Only in respect of sport. I ran for the squadron cross-country team, and I played for the squadron soccer team. But as a clerk, one, well, was out of things when it came to competitions appertaining to anything to do with flying.
Did you take any steps in the direction of becoming an NCO pilot yourself at this stage?
Well, before that, before I left Ryslip, every apprentice was given the opportunity to volunteer for training as a pilot. And this was done by everyone. I can't remember a single case of an apprentice not volunteering. But it meant absolutely nothing at all. It was an entry that was put on your documents, volunteered for training as an airman pilot and signed. But it meant completely nothing. I don't know that it was something that the powers that be had put in writing in case at some time or other you were killed or something while training as a pilot, and your kinsman said that He'd never wanted to be a pilot. He was forced to be against his will. That's the only thing I could think of. But it never meant anything at all.
Now, what sort of social life did you have at Upper Heyford? Did you there mix with local people at all?
Only in the pub. Now, of course, money wasn't too bad. As I was saying, the pay was quite reasonable, and beer in the local pub was only fourpence a pint of the old money, and one could get absolutely as drunk as could be for two bob, six pints, yes. So that was no trouble at all. Often used to go down to the local pub at one of the villages, and then of course into the Naffy too, where the beer was just as cheap. But every weekend, almost every weekend, sometimes what we call long weekend, sometimes short weekend, I used to go home from Upper Heyford. I had a motorcycle at first, almost as soon as I passed out. I passed out in the October, in the November. I borrowed some money from my mother and got myself a little second-hand motorcycle, and I was home virtually every weekend. Sometimes it was from Saturday midday, because even then we still worked on Saturday morning. But certainly not less than once a month. It would be for a long weekend, from Friday at about 4 until midnight on Sunday. But the regulations were very lax. They didn't worry at the guardroom if you were in by Monday morning before 8 o'clock. It was very easy.
Was there very much heavy drinking at all?
Not really. I think the heaviest drinking was by men who had done a tour overseas. Now, the tours overseas in those days, they were something. If one went to India, it was a 5-year tour. If one went to Egypt, it was a 5-year tour. Aden, Iraq, they were considered rough stations. They were only 2 years, but that wasn't a tour. That was the first 2 years, then one went on to India or Egypt or one of the, or even the Far East for 3 years. Now, over abroad, while they were abroad, they did learn to drink, some of them. And it wasn't looked upon as a serious offence in the forces. For instance, it was never CC, certainly not detention, or even CC. Drunkenness, and this is laid down in King's regulations, or was laid down, I haven't seen them since then. Drunkenness, first offence was fined 5 shillings by your CO. Second offence was fined 10 shillings. Third offence was fined 15 shillings. I think that subsequent things were added after the third offence, but as you see, it wasn't regarded as an offence. That was for plain drunkenness, but if it meant possibly knocking about a corporal or hitting an NCO or something like that, then of course it would be altogether different. But drunkenness in itself wasn't looked upon as bad. As long as he went back to his bed singing away, he was looked upon as harmless. I think that's how the police look at it.
Now, in 1937, after 4 years at Upper Heyford...
Well, yes, it was... actually, it was just under 3.5. Was posted to Iraq. I should have gone a year earlier, But my mother, she by this time, she was very ill with diabetes, and I got a compassionate a postponement of my overseas tours. It was put off, but in 1937 I applied again. But it made no difference. I went to Iraq.
Now, tell me about the actual journey out to Iraq. What was that like?
Oh, in the troop ship. I don't know whether it was the Nevassa or the Dorsetshire. On one of them I went, and the other I came back. I can't tell you that. But they were both exactly the same. That was grim. Serviceman today has got no conception everywhere he goes now. If he goes abroad, I mean, he flies. But the troop ship was roughing it. They were usually on a troop ship about 1,000 troops, soldiers and airmen, going to the various commands abroad. And I should say that well under a quarter of the ship was devoted to these 1,000 men. And the rest of the ship was the crew and the officers who were going out there. We slept in hammocks, and the hammock hooks were 18 inches apart. So you can guess how tightly we were packed when all the hammocks were up. As soon as we got into the Mediterranean, the slinging of hammocks ceased, and people found odd little spaces on deck and slept in the open, anything to get away from the dreadful atmosphere that was prevalent in the bowels of the ship.
How did you pass the time during the day?
Well, Crown and Anchor was actually allowed by regulations, and hours were spent playing Crown and Anchor. The beer was cheap on board. Cards, an awful lot of cards was played, I can well remember. I can also remember, too, the food wasn't particularly good, but it was plentiful. But for the first 3 days, no one wanted it.
Were people seasick?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Very, very seasick. I was one of the few who wasn't. I've never been seasick or air sick. And what tasty morsels we sometimes had, I certainly did well for those first few days, together with one or two others who were never seasick, because nobody could touch anything.
That must have been pretty nice down in the bottom of the ship, wasn't it?
Oh, golly, yeah. The bilges were... And the smell, it was the stink of the stuff, yes.
Now, what were your first impressions of Hinaidi when you...
Well, before we got to Hinaidi, I'm afraid I had some impressions before that. Impressions that were going to be... duplicated later on when I was a prisoner of war, and that was travelling in cattle trucks, in horse wagons, because we landed at Basra, which is some 300 miles from Baghdad. Hinaidi, incidentally, is a few miles outside Baghdad. And although 300 miles isn't very far for a railway journey in England. In Iraq, in those days, that train was timed to take 24 hours. And in each track, there was a sergeant or a flight sergeant, and I think it was 10 men. We were given rations, tinned food, such as bully beef and McConaughey's, which is a tinned stew, bread, and we ate very well for those 24 hours, travelling up, really, although it was discomfort with the hard wagon floors. I don't remember any palliasses or anything like that. We were quite happy, and we had 24 hours in these wagons which were designed to convey horses. And then we arrived at Hinady, where again it was luxury, there's no doubt about that. It was good. I was still in LAC at the time, but I shared a room, quite a spacious room, with two or more airmen. Both of them I had known at Ryslip. In fact, both of them had been in my entry, but they were starting on their second year in Iraq. So we were old friends, and I quickly settled down. They'd got a hot shower waiting for me as soon as I arrived, and some lovely clean linen set out, and they knew exactly what I'd been through, because they'd been through it 12 months before, and there was a lovely meal waiting. And I was actually at Hinady, and Hinady then was a very, very large Air Force camp. Three squadrons on it, and an aircraft depot with about 1,000 airmen, an armoured car company, and air headquarters. Now, I was posted to air headquarters, which consisted almost entirely of clerks. I should say the majority of whom I knew, because